When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
Now, still people come up to me and go, oh, not on telly anymore. You know, you're not on telly so much anymore. Where have you been? You know, it's like you've died because you're on telly and then suddenly you weren't. I might get a urinal-shaped gravestone. He said, look, everything good until it's shit. And everything shit until it's good. Oh, God, I just envy some people who just... Yeah, really, you know, I like my life, you know. You know, I often joke, you know, it was, and I am kind of joking, but there's something in it, is that, you know, it's basically, when I meet people like me, it's like blokes I'm quite wanting to go out drinking with and women I quite fancied. It was sort of, well, that's not how I put it to a priest.
Welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. Although maybe not today, maybe just the one will suffice, because my guest this week is a man who's found mindfulness when it comes to drinking, which I'm very intrigued to hear more about. He's been in our living rooms and on our radios for almost 30 years now and started his professional life as a sports reporter, a dream gig for a self-confessed football nut and lifelong West Brom fan. Born and raised in Quinton, Birmingham, he joined the BBC on work experience and moved between most notably Radio 5 Live and BBC Two, where for 10 years he hosted their live daily business show Working Lunch, all the while married to fellow broadcaster Jane Garvey, with whom he shares two adult daughters, Evie and Sian. Then came the call to host The Apprentice spin-off show, You're Fired, which made the BBC realise they'd been sitting on something of a gem of a broadcaster for way too long and decided to move him up the schedules to host first Match of the Day 2 and then The One Show alongside Christine Lampard, where they drove the show to huge ratings success. In 2008, such was his success, he was officially the most watched person on UK television, seen by over a billion viewers, unseating even Anton Deck from the top spot. As is often the way, the BBC's competition, ITV, decided that they wanted in on this ratings-winning double act and lured Adrian and Christine over to the channel to launch Daybreak. After a year of dawn calls, he swapped the breakfast sofa for the ITV sports studio and returned to Radio 5 Live, where he continues to this day to broadcast. In 2019, by now divorced for almost a decade, he began writing a column for The Guardian and subsequently went on to date and eventually marry the newspaper's editor, Catherine Viner. Having become a Catholic at the age of 39 and divorced at the age of 40, he remains a man of great faith, and in recent years has also been diagnosed with ADD, which is something he's talked about with refreshing honesty. In fact, refreshing honesty seems to be something of a theme in the many conversations he manages, be it with himself, or his readers, his listeners, or his viewers. So I'm really looking forward to talking to him today. Let's dial him in, shall we? It's Adrian Charles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm slightly overwhelmed by that very thorough biography.
Do you feel like I've stalked you?
Gone. Not so much that. I thought, Brian, when you say 30 years, is it really? But, you know, yeah. Of course it is, yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting what you say about honesty. It's just, I just think honesty sets you free. I can't, you know, maybe to my detriment, just, I don't know, I'm not trying to sound sort of worthy or anything, but I don't really know any other way to do it. It's not so much honesty, it's just sort of frankness and, you know, just, well, it is what is, and, you know, just to hell with the consequences of saying as much.
You kind of latched onto the 30 years that I mentioned there. But what was it like listening back to that, listening to your life reported back to you? Because I know for myself that, you know, if I had to write my own intro, it wouldn't be what somebody else would write for me. I think we often report ourselves in quite disparaging tones. Is it nice to hear somebody finding all the good in all you've done?
I know I've done loads of stuff, and it feels to me like if you imagine there's a bucket and into it goes all the stuff you've done in your life professionally, and then, you know, you keep accumulating and wake up every morning, every week, every year, and it's got a bit fuller, that bucket. What it means, like, there's a bucket with a hole in it. So, you know, every day I wake up and there's the bucket's absolutely empty again. I've achieved nothing, and I've got to start all over again. You know, unless if you're not careful, if I'm not careful, I end up taking that kind of view, which of course is the route to absolute madness. So, you know, you can't really go there.
As we enter into the festive season, your book becomes very meaningful again. I think this is the time where we socialise harder than any other time of the year. It is the season to be jolly. Talk to me about The Good Drinker, because I know that it's something that people talk to you about, not on a daily basis, but not far off it, in terms of being intrigued by the way you've managed to hold on to your drinking life in a really good way, rather than just having to kick it to the curb.
Yeah, I mean, I just tried to get across that, you know, for many big drinkers, it's, you know, the only way to really bring it to a, you know, to deal with it is to stop completely, at least for a, you know, at least for a few months. But there is another way. You know, there is another way. This might be appropriate for some people. It's important that this is out there. If only because there's so many drinkers who really need to address their drinking, but they're frightened to death of the idea of stopping drinking. So they're frightened. Some doctors are going to say, yes, you've got to stop completely, and they can't imagine their life without it. So that in itself ends with them not dealing with anything. You know, people have got to understand that, you know, there is a way of moderating. And look, even just moderating a bit helps. You know, let's say, you know, if you're drinking 50 units a week, you know, which is roughly, say, 20, 25 pints of beer, say, the recommended healthy amount is 14 units a week.
Which boils down to what, 7 pints?
About 7 pints. 7 pints a week, yeah. Or, a bottle of wine is about nine, 10 units. So, but the point is, people will hear those, heavy drinkers will hear that 14 units a week figure and think, well, I'll never get down to that. That's absolutely ridiculous. So they just won't bother. And what they need to understand is that if you go just down from 50 to 40 units a week, you're doing yourself a lot of good. In fact, you are doing yourself relatively more good than going from 50 to 40. You're making more of a difference, sort of proportionally, relatively, whatever the word is, than if you're going from 20 to 10 units.
Mm.
just because the way the harm curve works, without getting too technical about it. So marginal gains are available here. You know, you don't have to quit completely. You don't have to get down to 14 units a week to get some benefit from it.
What really resonated with me was your two drinks theory, right? And you were so right. The first drink, you know, that first glass of wine, for example, so I'm a wine drinker.
Yeah.
And for you, it would be the pint. You go, oh, that's nice, yeah, yeah. And then the second glass or the second pint sort of supports that. And that's nice. Yeah. And I'm kind of nice on two glasses. And then by the third, you're just chasing what's gone.
Yeah.
And all that lies in after that, for me at this stage in my life, is a hangover. On two glasses, I'm good.
Yeah.
And that was your recommendation. Well, not recommendation, but that was your observation, which is, you know, those first two are that's really what you're there for.
Well, the whole book was sort of about changing the mindset a bit on it and just allowing everyone to take a long look at themselves about how you to really understand and appreciate what's going on. So the point was making that you have that first drink, and for whatever reason, that first drink, you know, makes you feel better, gives you a change of emotional state. And then the second drink, much less so. And then every subsequent drink is just a futile attempt to recreate the feeling that the first drink gave you.
It's interesting, when you read the book, you really get the sense of your own self-discovery, how you're learning about yourself. You're looking back and you're collecting learnings from your writing. So with that in mind, I'd like to jump to my first question, if that's okay.
Go on, then. Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about the lessons that you've accrued having left school. Life lessons, right? Be it via therapy, be it via fame and its misfortune and the misfortune it can bring, finding faith in Catholicism, marrying, divorcing, marrying again, being diagnosed with ADD. I mean, like, every time you tackle any of these subjects, you really put yourself out there as the story. And I love that about you as a journalist, because so many journalists hide themselves away from being the narrative. And I just wondered, having written about all of that and your relationship with drink, what have been the most informative acquired life lessons that you have collected across the course of your adult life?
My agent actually has it's hardly that insightful, but it really sticks in my mind. He said, look, everything good until it's shit and everything shit until it's good. Now he's talking, you know, he's obviously been an agent. He's talking about career, you know, and work and stuff. But I think it's really important to bear in mind, it's particularly important to focus on both sides of that. And actually, the best side to focus on is the bit which is everything shit until it's good. That's the bit to focus on. If you're preoccupied with the other side, as I am, if I'm not careful, then it's kind of, well, everything's good until it's shit. So you can't enjoy anything because you think, well, you know, any kind of success is like when West Brom score a goal. I think, well, I'm going to feel that much more miserable when we end up losing this game. I mean, it literally is like that. And I've just got to, you know, so I think the problem is as you get older, you can see lessons. You could learn them, take it on board, but actually enacting it is difficult, you know, because you get so set in your mental ways. You know, it's really, really hard. I swapped my bins around in my kitchen where the recycling was. I mean, literally about 6 years ago, the recycling was and where the ordinary bin was, I'd swap places, right, for reasons too boring to go into. And to this day, I still go to the wrong bin. You know, because it was just hardwired into me. So in terms of learning lessons, the first one is to see what kind of person you are, how you are, appreciate how you think, right? And then I think the second one is working out, which is where therapy comes in. The therapy comes in the first bit, but also in the second bit, into okay, so why do I think like that? Why am I like that? I've seen how I am.
Mm.
Then you ask, why am I like that? Now, those two, you know, are worth doing probably. But then they need to lead to the third one is, okay, well, how am I going to change? And that is so hard.
That's the tricky bit.
That's the tricky bit. And you've, you know, the older you get, the harder it can be to sort of work on to achieve that. And I think, I mean, what it slightly comes back to drinking. If you're drinking less, I just think I absolutely get the benefits of drinking, and I still get them, and so on. But you know, I think drinking loads all the time just can be a substitute for clear thinking, or can certainly get in the way of clear thinking. So when the fog of alcohol clears, you can see things more clearly. You're probably a bit less depressed and anxious, you just have these moments when you think, blimey, wise up. You know, it's a bit like when somebody close to you and young gets ill and dies. I mean, as horrific as that is, there's a moment of something approximating, I don't know what the word is, but there's something approximating positivity when you think, well, hang on, I've got to just enjoy my life. I've got to enjoy what I've got left. You know, I've got to, you know, I can't get hung up on work or some aspect of relationship or something. You know, the only thing you can do is just make sure you enjoy life. But you capture that in that moment. It's almost euphoric. It's almost euphoric at that moment. Yes, you know, yeah. I've got to take from this tragedy to really enjoy life. And you have it for a matter of minutes sometimes, so then it goes again. And you're back, you know, you're back smashing the house up because you can't find your car keys or something. Yeah. Well, I remember ages ago, I think I was struggling with something. I wasn't having a particularly good time. I was a bit down about something. And I went out somewhere with some friends. It wasn't really my kind of night. It was somewhere bloody flash and expensive in London. And I was out with a load of rugby players, bizarrely. There's a friend of mine used to play for England, and I was out with him and some of his crowd. And there was a rugby player there. And he was married to this. I mean, I'll be honest. She was absolutely staggering looking, and she was a model and also a concert pianist. And I wasn't. And she wasn't making it up, because I googled her at some stage. Yeah, that's what she was, a modeler and a concert pianist. But anyway, I was chatting to her, and she said, and I was moping away about it. And she said, look, something you've got to remember is that, you know, happiness is a lifestyle choice. Yeah, I think about that every day, and she was right. But knowing that doesn't mean you can sort of do it. You know, it's not as easy as putting on a different colour pair of socks. You know, you've got to really try hard at it.
It is hard. And I think sometimes we have to go through difficult kind of, you know, heartaches, I suppose, to remind us to enjoy the good bits. I think there's no way to learn life's lessons without getting a few dents in the bonnet along the way. Would that be your experience?
I think that's true to some extent. But there's a guy I go to the football with, to West Brom with. He goes to every game. An old fella called Alan Cleverly, his name is, and he always wears a hat. And he, on the way to matches, he always is absolutely certain we're going to win. I am 100% certain we are going to lose. And he said to me once, he said, look, the difference between me and you is we're both going to have the same journey home. Right, if West Brom have won, you'll be, we'll be happy. West Brom have lost, we'll be miserable. The difference is I have a much happier journey there. because I'm looking forward to it. You seem to be dreading it. And the other thing he said once, actually, is just after we, you know, we were winning 2-0, you know, with 1 minute left and ended up winning 3-2, and we had to get back from Sunderland or whatever it was. And I remember saying once, he said, look, without despair, there is no joy.
Yes.
So, I mean, to your point about life being a zero-sum game, I think there's something in that. But it's not absolutely necessary, I don't think. Some people are just happy with what they've got, you know, and just, you know, these are the people I admire most, you know. And, you know, even sometimes it can come down to a lack of ambition and a lack of drive, which, you know, is a contemptible thing in some people's eyes. But, oh, God, just, you know, I just envy some people who just, yeah, really, you know, I like my life, you know. Oh, you know, do you want to do better? Do you want to be, you know, instead of being a teacher, do you want to be a headmaster? You know, instead of being, you know, I don't know, a sword carrier, don't you want to be the star of the play? He said, no, I really just really enjoy it. I thought, I admire that so much. I admire that more than any of the biggest achievers ever.
Contentment,
yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I do this thing on my radio show called The Winner's Enclosure, where we interview winners, people who won lots of stuff. And it's very interesting. They divide about halfway down the middle between those who do it for the love of winning. Do it for the love of the sport is the main thing. But when you're a professional, that can wane when it becomes your livelihood. But just love winning. There's an extraordinary number of people who are in it because they hate losing. It's not to do with winning. Yeah. It's about just hate losing. And there's some big stars who really couldn't tell you anything about their winning moments. But they can remember losing in a school football match final when they were 13. You know, that's etched on their memory. You know, so again, to your point about joy and despair, if it's the fear of the despair that's driving you, I'm not sure that's quite right.
No, but I think you need one to offset the other, don't you? I mean, yeah. and it's all about disposition, because, you know, what you've just described there is pretty much somebody that chooses not to walk on the sunny side of the street. And, you know, yeah. It's like your mate that goes to the football with you. He's walking on the sunny side of the street. You're staying in the shade because it's probably going to be shit on the way home and, you know, the result's not going to be ours. And it's about how you view things. I wonder what it is then that has driven you to some of those big changes in your life. Like, for example, Catholicism. Were you in a happy, skipping into the church state of mind when you started to explore faith?
I suppose it's a long story, but the simple version is probably the most truthful one, actually. It's that I'd always been a believer. And I often think that's genetic, really. I think it's like being in, you're either into football or you're not, and there's no reason why some people are and some people aren't. I think some people, I just felt it in my bones. There was something, I had some sense of the supernatural, if you like, or some sense of God or something. And my parents and my brother are complete, I mean, you couldn't call them agnostics, they're just atheists or whatever the word is when you just think the whole business is a load of bollocks. And I just remember I'd always been kind of a believer, but never found really a church to go to. But then when I was in my late 30s, a friend of mine was a Catholic. He said, "Why don't you just come? Do you want to come to Mass with me?" I said, "All right, yeah, fine." So I went to Mass with him, and I just felt at home there. I can't, you know, I didn't, you know, I wasn't looking up and seeing the angels singing or anything. I just felt at home. I felt like I was with people a bit like me. You know, I often joke, you know, it was, and I am kind of joking, but there's something in it. Is that, you know, it's basically, when I meet people like me, it's like blokes I'm quite wanted to go out drinking with and women I quite fancied. It was sort of, well, that's not how I put it to a priest.
No.
Obviously, but it just felt, you know, but I just sort of felt at home there. And I think, I think in stuff like politics and, I don't know, you know, managing your money or, I don't know, various things. You know, you've got to beware, you've got to go with what you think rather than you feel. So you got to go what you feel. So you don't go with sort of facts rather than sort of anecdotes. You know, just because you happen to get mugged doesn't mean crime is rising for everybody. You know, it's quite difficult to separate. But I think, or all sorts of stuff is like that. You got to some extent, you got to examine the facts and go with your head to some extent rather than your heart. But, you know, with religion, I think if there's ever a time when you can say, look, it's just what I feel here. It's not what I think. I mean, if I couldn't sit down and map it out on a piece of paper, God exists, Christ died for us all, is how the Holy Spirit works. I mean, I've never troubled myself to do that. I mean, I just think that's theology, and I just think it's a bit ludicrous to me. It's just go with, you know, what you feel. If you sit there and feel something that approximates peace, then fine. That's it. I mean, it's that simple. And always it was about showing gratitude. You know, I think.
Mm.
You know, so who do you thank? Who do you thank? It's always been in my mind, that question. I mean, donkeys years ago, I interviewed Michael Owen after he'd been brilliant at the age of 17, I think, in the 98 World Cup. It's called Brilliant Goal for England. And I said, how do you feel after that goal? You know, who did you thank? Who do you thank? And he was going, oh, no. He just, I mean, it was a fatuous question in a sense, and he certainly didn't have an answer for it. He goes, oh, no, mum and dad, I suppose. Look, which is perfectly, you know, it's a perfectly good answer. I'm not mocking him for one minute. But, you know, for me, there was a need to, you know, just sort of, you know, thank God. You know, look, atheists go, thank God. They say thank God. An atheist will also look at the heavens and say, oh, thank God. You know, but, you know, I suppose that's just what I do. I mean, the obvious point is that the other side of the coin doesn't apply. So when something bad happens to me, logically, or I suppose I would within my right, since I'm always thanking God for good things. If something bad happens, I should be going, well, thank you very much. You know, but I don't feel like that about God for some reason, which is absolutely illogical. So in any theological argument, you know, I'd be torn apart for that. But I'm just not, you know, I just. That's just the way, you know, that's just the way it is.
Well, you talk about illogical. You're the only person that I can think of that became a Catholic and a year later got divorced.
Yeah. I think they're still shaking their heads about that at the Vatican. But I mean, I don't think any, look, I mean, on a personal level, I don't, you know, but I mean, most priests aren't like non-Catholics thing. They're just very kind, sort of humane people, and just sort of, you know, and saying, look, we all go through stuff, you might have regrets, you might not, but, you know, just sit here and be quiet and be peaceful, and hopefully something will start making sense to you. That's about the extent to it. I mean, there's issues in the Catholic Church over can you take communion and can you confess and all this business, but, you know, yeah, in the end, just, you know, whatever. I can always find a priest to talk to, so, you know, and that's, you know, that's fine.
The lessons that you've extracted from faith, from therapy, from moderating your drinking, we've discussed. What did you learn about fame? Because you were already incredibly successful before you became incredibly famous. And I think the two are very different beasts.
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't thought of it like that. At some measure, I was... By some measure, I was successful, but I was never particularly felt it. You know, I was on telly and radio a lot without anyone really noticing, then passed some tipping point and then got really famous. And then I was famous and successful. Then, that's a really interesting way of, now you mentioned it, it's really interesting. So at the beginning, I was kind of successful. Relative to whom, I don't know, but you kind of were successful, but not particularly famous. Then I got famous, I was famous and successful. And then to some extent, it all went wrong. And then I was, in my own mind, to some extent, rather unsuccessful all of a sudden, but still bloody famous. Now that's hard then, because you're constantly, hard. And I'm sure you'll understand what I mean when I say, you know, you, and we all get to this in life in some respect, whether you're famous or not, but you're kind of judged or defined, rather, you defined by what you used to do.
Totally.
You know, you know, I write, you know, I do a lot of writing, and I go on the radio, and I'm, you know, and I find that much more fulfilling and so on. But still, you know, still people come up to me and go, oh, not on telly anymore. You know, the you're not on telly so much anymore. Where have you been? You know, it's like you've died because you're on telly and then suddenly you weren't. And then
I had one today from somebody very well-meaning, and they do, and you have it all the time. Adrian, I really resonated with me.
Oh, the well-meaning ones are worse.
Yeah, because they're like, it's like you say, it's like, well, where have you been? You're like, well, I work every day, and I listen. I love what I do for a living. I feel very, very fulfilled, but I do understand that syndrome of being, as you say, successful, then famous and successful, and then famously unsuccessful. And that's a very tricky territory to navigate. It is, and to come out of that feeling not pickled by it or fried or cynical, and just to come out of it healthy, really, with your mental health intact. And I think I probably underestimated how difficult it was until I was way through it. And then you look back and you go, gosh, that was a lot. But not in comparison to some of the things that we're seeing going on in the world. But certainly through my time reading your work, I really got it. That thing where people cock their heads and go, not on telly anymore. It's like you've died, but you haven't. You're fine.
I mean, you're right. When people are trying to be nice,
people
are trying to be nice. They get like, there's one guy on a train back from Manchester. So I had exactly this conversation, and at the end he goes, "Oh well, you tried your best anyway, didn't you?" I mean, you know, if you could get the windows of the Pendolino open, I would have probably thrown myself out. You know, it was just mad. But
let's reframe that, right? You are a broadcaster of 30 years' experience with a show on one of the biggest networks in radio. You're a celebrated author, and you write for one of the most credible newspapers, not just here in the UK, but anywhere in the world, really, with The Guardian. Yeah. So, I mean, that to me reads like success, but isn't it funny how other people read it? Just because you're not on the Daybreak sofa or going hello and welcome to the One Show. And yet, listening back to some of the stuff you've done, that was some of the most unfulfilling work that you've ever done in comparison to the stuff you do now.
Yeah. Oh, look, it was, it was fun, but no, it wasn't, anything successful is fulfilling to some extent. I mean, people are really enjoying the show and seeming to like you. Sort of that's fulfilling as well. So I don't want to denigrate it at all. It makes me sound bitter and so on. But, you know, it is not like, look, if I'd done a one show and, you know, 6 million people have watched it and said, oh, that's great. That's great. That's nice. But, you know, it's a big team effort. You know, there's Christine or if it's co-presenting somebody else on the show, there'd be others there. There's a big team. There's, you know, the cameras, the crew and everything. And that's what's kind of good about it. It's a big team effort. But on the, you know, or I'd book, you know, 20 million people and watched a football match. Well, you know, 20 million people would have watched it. You know, if you'd started the game when the referees whistle and finished it on the final whistle, they would have still have watched it. So I couldn't take that much credit for it. But, I mean, with radio, it's kind of different, especially if you're doing it's still a team effort, don't get me wrong, but if you're doing a solo speech radio show for 2 or 3 hours, then, you know, if it's any good, you can probably take a good share of the credit for that. I mean, most purely of all is writing a column for The Guardian. So if somebody stops me in the street and says, if they don't say, you know, oh, you used to be on telly or something, but if they said, I thought that program you did on X was great, that's nice. Or I used to like Working Lunch, that's great. Or The One Show, whatever, fine. But if somebody says, I thought that Guardian article you wrote was great, then, I mean, I just want to hug them, really. I can't, you know, in fact, I stick to them so long, they start getting quite alarmed then. I think they start sort of backing off me as well. on a Wednesday morning, and we're recording this on a Wednesday. At 7 o'clock this morning, I had a blank sheet of paper, and I was sitting in a Cafe Nero in Starbridge thinking, oh, come on, what? I've got 1,000 words here. What am I going to write? Come on, please. And then to have actually dragged something out of yourself and send it in, and it goes in, and then just somebody, one person reads it. Or, somebody likes, anybody stops me and likes it. I just think, wow, what a privilege it's been to be given that opportunity. That's fulfillment.
Yeah. That's what, sorry, I wasn't being disparaging about the work you've done before, but
no,
I can understand that having a chance to fill a blank canvas with something that somebody's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, I really enjoyed that. Get that. 3 minutes on an interview where you don't want to let the team down because so many people have had a hand in what those 3 minutes look like. It's just a different experience, right? It's kind of also, like eating from a buffet versus fine dining.
But it's also, in all that kind of stuff, doing football or the one show or whatever, the interviews were 3 minutes long. It became difficult for me to have a conversation longer than 3 minutes in a pub. I'd be fire off three questions, get three answers. Thank you very much. Next, please. You go into this business because you're curious about stuff and you want to ask people questions because you're interested in the answers. Now, I stopped doing that for years, really, especially going on football because before the game, you say, what do you think, Lee? What do you think, Roy? What do you think, whoever? And then at halftime, the same. What do you think? What do you think? Just one answer with some clips that we've arranged they're going to show to illustrate the game. It's not, just very occasionally. Well, one time, for reasons too boring to go into, I ended up with like 12 minutes with a football manager who's Roberto Martinez, which helped because he's a really... being a really intelligent guy. And I knew him a bit. But, I was really asking him questions. I remember a real conversation. I felt the blood flowing back into my veins, It was, to me, that's what it's all about. And in fact, that's my big lesson in life. I want to get something I realised I admire in people the most. I admire people with knowledge. But I admire people just as much, if not more, for what they want to know rather than what they do know. I'm constantly being... I think when somebody young's come into the business, they're one of my producers on the radio, they seem at pains to stress what they do know. And that's great, right? But just I'm far more impressed by, about a story. I'm not going to tell you what I know about Israel. If somebody says... what I'd really like to understand is this, and this about this situation. Then, that's clever to me. That's something special because you really want to know. I say, okay, well, to be honest, I don't know the bloody answer. So let's the two of us find out and then we'll make something of that.
And you fertilize that conversation together. Yeah.
Yes, but it takes some guts to say that if you're just coming into the business because you're trying to prove your worth by what you know. But to me, the biggest thing you can say is, not so much, I don't know, but I don't know, but I really want to know. This is what I really want to understand.
It's really interesting. And listen, what I love about listening to your response to these questions is... you're still learning. You're still curious.
Yeah.
That hunger, that appetite for knowledge has not abated. Yeah.
Hold up. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Can we jump to my next question?
Yeah.
My next question for you, Adrian. The midwife who delivered you said to your mother, "This is no baby, this is a man." And I thought that was a rather brilliant, bold first impression. And I wondered when else people have jumped to big first impressions of you. And are they often right or more often wrong?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think, well, there's first impressions face to face, and there's first impressions on air. And, I think they're more, they can be different. And I think in my case, they're not that different. So I'm more or less as I am on telly and radio, as I am in real life. But that in itself can become an act, because it's the hardest thing in the world to be natural on TV. So in the end, I've always sort of questioned myself: am I just being natural, or am I playing the part of myself looking natural? But anyway, that's not quite you're asking to go.
No, but and therein lies the madness, right? Of what you do, yeah, right? Because you start to go, is this me, or is this the person I think that they want me to be?
Yeah.
Who actually even am I anymore?
Yes, that's true. But what I'm not is, then you would have met plenty of people like this who will come across as the friendliest, man of the people on the telly, and then you meet them in real life, they're utter grumps and don't want anything to do with anyone. Or vice versa, somebody who comes across as a real grump, but is actually really sweet and nice when you meet them. And, I'm sure you, like me, have met both categories. I think...
Yeah.
I think... I think people get you wrong in all sorts of ways. I mean, people have always said... The question I'm always asked is, how have you managed to get on with the West Midlands, Birmingham accent? And I always said, it's to my advantage. And I do believe it's true, because when people first hear you, which is still true to some extent, people first hear you, they assume you're thick, really. It's one of those accents where people
think
make
you
sound thick. Oh, yeah, I do. Even more so back in the day. And I just know it was definitely my advantage, because the expectations were lower. So I had to do less relatively to impress them. I just, when I first started the BBC walking with my knuckles dragging along the floor. And then I just string a sentence together. I thought, oh, my, the lad, this lad's a bloody genius. Well, I haven't really done anything. But again, that's a misreading because, you know, which I've made the most of, you know, people assuming I'm thick when I'm probably not quite as thick. I think people also assume, and it's partly a ADD thing, I think, but it's partly, and sometimes I am in a way with the fairies and not lose interest. I just get distracted and I'm just go to a different place mm-hmm. instead. But often I can look distracted. I can look like I'm not listening when in fact I am, or I can look bored when in fact I'm really interested. Now, yeah. That's a misreading of me. Now, it's partly my fault because I've got to, you know, look interested as well as be interested. You know, I get that. But, you know, that's a misreading of you, of your personality mm-hmm. as well. Something happened once in this clinic I sort of went when I'm seeing this psychologist, and you rarely talk to people in the waiting room there for obvious reasons. Mm. There's rarely anybody in there actually. But one time there's this woman there and she said, oh, I saw you on telly last night, blah, blah. And I was chatting to her, oh yeah, how you doing? Blah, you know, where are you from? What were you watching? Oh, what do you think of that? And then she said, oh, you seem like a really nice guy on there. You seem like a really nice guy on the telly. And it turns out you are a really nice guy. And I said, oh, well, you know, if you knew me better, you might not think that, blah, blah. But then my sort of shrink was standing behind me and he said, and we went into our room and he said, why were you so nice to her? And I went, well, I just was. He said, no, but why? Well, he said, no, really, really think. Let's think why. And then what we got down to is that I was thinking, well, she gets home tonight. She says to her partner, whoever, he said, oh, I met that bloke on the telly. You know, that has to, you would have thought, elicit the question, what was he like? And then I want her to say, oh, he's a really nice guy. And then he said, well, why do you care? I said, well, I do, because I'm a nice person. I do care. I said, look, you know, he said, do you have any idea the pressure you're putting on yourself under? You know, if you care that much, you want everybody to like you. You know, it'll drive you mad. You know, I think he's right. So again, that falls in this category. You know, I mean, there was one I donkeys years ago when I was like 12 or something. My mum had some. We were on holiday with some friends, and they on a previous holiday. They'd bumped into, and it's funny how the details stick in my mind. They were at the Isle of Wight on holiday and they bumped into John Noakes in a shop. Right. John Noakes was the then, it's a bit before your time, but a legendary.
No, I remember we Shep. Okay. What was his name?
Yeah.
No, the dog's name?
Shep was his dog.
It was Shep, yeah. Yeah. John Noakes, legend.
And every, you know, and he was a legendary figure, presenter of Blue Peter. And I remember he said, oh, you know, this little girl, she went up to him and said hello. This girl's dad went, yeah, he was quite grumpy, actually. And do you know what? Through my whole, every time I thought about him, or even on the day he died, I thought, hey, grumpy. He was grumpy, he was. I mean, I had no,
that's well, so
I had
unfair,
one
isn't it?
Scrap of it, that one little girl, one family reached that conclusion. I mean, his cat might have been run over that morning. He might have just stubbed his toe. He might just have been having a bad day. Yeah, I judged him my whole life. And I sort of, at some
really
level,
harshly.
I live in fear of it. Yeah, I've been judged in the same way myself.
That's what you should have told your shrink. Have you heard the one about John Noakes? That's how I ended up being nice to that lady.
Yeah, absolute bastard, apparently.
Really interesting, isn't it, when we think about, like you say, the pressure you put yourself under so that people that you'll probably never meet again will think well of you.
Yeah, yeah.
The human ego. My third and final question kind of hangs on something I read at the weekend. It was an interview with Dame Judi Dench where she revealed that every time she loses someone dear to her, she plants a tree for them in her garden. So at the foot of her garden, she has trees planted in gratitude and in commemoration of, for example, her late husband, Michael Williams, her brother, Sir John Gielgud, and all the way to kind of a recently planted sapling that has a label that reads Helen McCrory. And you talked about gratitude earlier. And I love the idea of how that would manifest itself by way of the trees that you might populate your own forest with. Who are the people that you would plant for?
I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I always think I never... Oh, that's right. I was talking to my mum because she wanted me to do some sticky labels. I mean, she's 84. And she wanted to do some sticky address labels for her Christmas cards. And she had she'd done it ages ago. So she had a whole list and we were going through. So, no, they're dead. They're dead. They're dead. No, they've gone. Well, he's dead, but she isn't. So you have to change it to Mrs. Smith rather than Mr. and Mrs. Smith, etc. And I was just thinking on my own phone, I've got all these contacts, like my, you know, but, you know, there's people who died 30 years ago whose number is still in my phone. I just never can quite bring myself to delete it.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it's just, I mean, it's sort of everybody. I mean, you know, some of your experience. I mean, I'm trying to think of, I haven't got many enemies, but if one of them died, would I take the phone out? Would they take the contact out? Then I don't think I would. But I mean, I haven't got a, you know, I haven't got a lot of land or anything to plant millions of trees on. So
it's a metaphorical forest, don't you worry.
I know it is. I know. I'm just thinking.
We're talking about gratitude. Maybe it's the teacher that made the difference. It's the first job interview where they allowed you to screw up but still gave you the job anyway. I don't know. It's those people that afforded you an opportunity to be grateful.
Yes, there are people who, I mean, it's impossible to split up with the people who really, really significantly change your life by, well, you know, like just the simplest level is, you know, when people ask me, how'd you get to be a TV presenter? I always say, well, you only need one thing and that's somebody daft enough to give you something to present. In the end, somebody's got to take that decision. I mean, although you'd be the best presenter in the world, nobody's going to know it if nobody gives you anything to present, you know. So, so there's a, you know, I've got somebody like that for radio and somebody like that for telly. I mean, the latter certainly became a very close friend. And he you know, there'd be a tree for him. He's no longer with us. But, you know, I think it'd just be people who said just something, you know, very small and kind. Just at the right time, and you just, you know, just it might be just a kind note or letter or, you know, and I just, you know, and it just a phrase, you know, can really. I mean, there was one last week. There's a comedian called Laura Smith, who I heard do a brilliant thing. She used to be a teacher. She did a brilliant thing on Radio 4. Just a little 2-minute love letter to school trips, saying how important school trips were.
You wrote a column about it, I saw.
Yes, and then wrote a column about it. So I sent, and it was a direct lift from what she said, basically. So I sent it, so I'd made contact with Laura by this time, so I just sent her it, just so she's happy with what I'd written. And she sent me the most beautiful email back ever. I mean, I'll treasure it. You know, so, you know, God, I just needed that. It was just so sweet and nice for somebody who owed me nothing, you know, I don't know, never met. Hopefully I will meet her and just, or it can be a kindness to the stranger in the, you know, in the street sometimes. You just meet I'm struggling to find an example here, but.
What about the friend that took you to your first mass? You know, that's had a profound...
Oh, yeah, that absolutely goes, you know, that I suppose that goes without saying. But, I mean, that goes without saying, you know. So, and I'm grateful to a lot of friends. But, you know, there is also, and, you know, and they're the main ones. But there's also, God, you know, some other people who've just said the right thing at the right time. And, you know, and you almost want to write them down so you don't forget them. It's a bit like I always make, there's brilliant little lines and passages in books. And I read a lot of stuff digitally, you know, on the phone. And I always highlight it and there's an app you can sort of save them in. And then they come back and remind you every day, 5 of them. So it's those things I'm reading. You know, there's a lot of brilliant, brilliant things. Without that app, I would have forgotten. you know, I would have forgotten about it. It's great to be reminded. You see, it's like little kindnesses people have said and done down the line that I wish I'd made a note of them. In fact,
there's a column in that, Adrian. I can hear it now.
There is a column. There is a column in that. You're right.
You won't be scratching around in Starbucks next week.
But instead of planning it out and writing it, I'll have a blank page next Wednesday, and I'm in a bloody panic all over again.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, like when we go back to the idea of planting a tree, there was the therapist that you went to, the doctor that you went to see, who wrote to you with your diagnosis, but you never got the letter.
Actually, yeah, that was 3 years later.
So you lived with kind of like ignorance, really, for way longer than you needed to better understand yourself. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure there's gratitude in that, but maybe not quite that let you down.
It was good in the end, but I mean, in those 3 years between the kind of the test and the diagnosis, I mean, there was some pretty shoddy decision making in that time, you know, but anyway, I got there in the end, so you know, it was fine. And I'm, you know, as far as ADD is concerned, I'm one of the lucky ones, you know, that most people who need that treatment are never going to get it because they can't afford to pay for it. You know, it's just it's about private medicine. You know, and I'd sort of give my diagnosis and my medication away to somebody who needs it, or somebody who's probably in prison because they never got anywhere at school. You know, turn to crime, addiction issues, whatever. You know, for want of proper help with their mental health. You know, who probably weren't sort of high functioning like I suppose I was, if sort of miserable with it. But you know, it's never had those advantages, and they, you know, it's just, you know, something's got to change there.
It has, because otherwise it's just virtue signalling from those at the top that sort of go.
Exactly.
It's really important that you go and speak to somebody, but there's no one to speak to.
No, absolutely.
It's really important you get a diagnosis. There's no one to diagnose you.
And it's also, it's creating a false impression. You know, it's creating a false impression like, you know, that the only people you get to hear talking about ADHD are the high-functioning ones, clever dicks like me who come out and talk about it bravely and all that, which is bollocks. Now you come out and talk about it, and then so the only people in the public domain who are talking about having ADHD are the ones who are doing very well. You know, when in fact the ones, you know, it's creating a false impression that it's somehow a good thing to have. You know, that you can do well with it. It's just not. It's not any. I met a specialist in autism one time. He said one of the worst things to happen, he said, for autism was the film Rain Man, when, you know, it was, you know, autism was seen as this superpower. So look, it's got that element to it, and thank goodness for that. But, you know, it is seriously, seriously, seriously debilitating for a lot of people, a lot of young people and their families.
Yeah, trying to exist within the framework of a society that doesn't cater for it. Hopefully that is changing, and people are accepting the brilliance and the many different traits that an autistic mind can contribute to the wider world.
No, that's absolutely true. But it's also very difficult and challenging for some, and they need help. And like ADHD is very difficult and very challenging, predominantly for those who can't afford to see a psychiatrist, who are going to wait 5 years for a consultation, who are never going to get the help they need. You know, that's the real tragedy there. And we're making it look almost as though they don't exist. You know, it's like, oh, we're doing really well. We've got ADHD. You know, it's quite a thing. You know, something's got to change there.
It's really interesting that you raise that. And one of the most detailed conversations we've had on the show over the 4.5 years we've been going around this was with Sean Ryder, who has received a very late in life diagnosis, much like yourself, only because his children were all diagnosed and then thought, hang on a minute, I probably should look at myself. And has now started to unpick it. And it was really quite distressing to listen to him laying out all of his mistakes and understanding how they occurred. And also that he said, the only time I ever felt like I was in tune with the rest of the world, in as much as, you know, the society and the society norms and expectations, was when I was on heroin. That's a lot, isn't it? To try to get your head around. And I've felt like, you know, I'm a hot break for him, because that's a life of being wildly misread, misunderstood, misguided, mistreated, you know, just a lot of mess.
But I think he obviously needed help, which he wasn't going to get. You know, society was different when he was growing up. And thankfully his kids have had help.
Mm. Do you understand yourself better now that you understand your diagnosis?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah, no, I absolutely do. But actually changing the behaviour, like I said before, you know, is you can understand yourself, but changing it, you know, is different. But, you know, do I work harder to? Yes. I try to, but it's a real discipline. And, you know, medication is only a part, probably only a small part of the answer. And in fact, it can be a bit of a cheat in a way. I mean, I'm really glad I've got it. But, suddenly there's a shortage of ADHD medication. Mm. And I just thought, well, in my case, hang on, then, you know, what would I do if I just couldn't get it? Well, I would really have to work hard at it. You know, different mindfulness techniques, just thinking carefully about how I got through the day, you know, and that wouldn't do any harm, probably. It wouldn't do me any harm to really practice those techniques.
No, but it would make your days harder.
It would make my days harder, but it might help me find a way of thinking my way out of it. It sounds like I'm being cynical about it. I'm not, but you are never going to change yourself with medication alone.
No, it's managing it though, isn't it? Excuse my ignorance on this, and you will be able to tell me way better than I ever could find out for myself. But does it not give you a better base to build from? So if you're medicated, then you can make more rational decisions around other lifestyle changes and mindfulness techniques to really build on it. So they complement one another.
Yes, they do. But if you've got to always remember it's about both. Now, it can give you the base, but you won't necessarily use that base. You say, oh, I feel a bit better now taking that, fine. You know, crack on. You say, hang on, it's not job done. You've then got to it still requires work. You know, it's like, you know, you've got a better pair of running shoes. You've still got to run the race.
Yeah, you've still got to run.
Even though, you know, you've still got to run,
Just less blisters. It's been really fascinating talking to you. I love reading your column.
Thank you very much.
Highlight was the confession of your in-house urinal, by the way.
I don't know, if only it was that simple.
I mean, most people have the bougie bidet in the 80s. You've now taken it all the way through to the noughties with an in-house urinal.
I've got a bidet and a urinal, in fact. In fact, my friends at school, my mom always was a big fan of you, of a, not urinal, of a bidet. And when my kids came round my friends came round for tea when I was little, they always used to wasn't it. So, you know, it was like a proto urinal.
I'm just intrigued. Were you surprised by the reaction to that column?
Well,
because
it's
something that people in the office have mentioned. Like, you know, I go, oh, we've got Adrian Charles on the podcast. He goes, you know, he's got a urinal in his house. It's like, no, but I do know that he's got a 30-year career in broadcasting.
I'd mentioned it. It wasn't the first time I'd mentioned it. I'd mentioned it on the telly. I'd mentioned it. I'd written about it in The Sun. I might even have mentioned it in a previous column. I'd talked about it on the radio. It just wasn't a secret. It's just funny. It's like a tipping point. It is suddenly, it became a thing, but it wasn't new news, you know. It felt to me like suddenly I said, what, have you heard? He's a West Brom fan. You're never. Are you a West Brom fan? It's like, I thought everybody knew this. You know, it just wasn't. You know, it was just bizarre. I don't know. I can't explain it. I give it an affectionate pat every day.
I think it's something that people will read in your obituary, Adrian. It's that important.
That's
what it's become.
There's a thought. I might get a urinal-shaped gravestone.
Thank you so much to Adrian Charles. And don't forget his book, The Good Drinker, is available now wherever you get your books, just in time for the season where we may all be tempted to get a little bit too jolly. Now, if that's left you in the mood for more conversation with fellow broadcasting giants, why not have a rummage around in our back catalogue, where you'll find episodes with Ken Bruce, Lorraine Kelly, Sean Ryder, who we mentioned there, not a broadcasting legend, but a legend nonetheless. Simon Mayo's in there, Eamon Holmes, Ruth Langsford, Vernon Kay, Richard and Judy, Ben Shepherd. I mean, I could go on. And I'll be back on your feeds on Tuesday with more vintage cuts from the cellar. Until then, thanks so much for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.